you, Ken. And thank you to all of our presenters. We're now going to go ahead and go through the question and answer session. If I could ask the presenters to try to, you know, be as, you know, give the best answer you can, but also be quick in your answers so we could try to get through as many questions as possible. I'm just going to start from the top of the list. I think the first question, Steve, was for you, and it said that now that food and energy costs are again rising, what is the likelihood that rising energy and food prices will dampen GDP growth?
Well, thanks for the question. First of all, baked into that forecast are those rising energy costs. We have commodity costs baked into the forecast of about 5 to 10% higher just over the course of the year. And that includes, you know, oil, includes food, things of that nature. So those increases are baked in. Now there is enough pent up demand that we think that we can withstand some increase above that. Now, you know, if we have another shock, for example, for fuel prices like we saw in 2008, that does put the recovery potentially in jeopardy. I would say if it had happened last year, it would put us much more in jeopardy than this year. I think the economy is a little bit more able to withstand that, more so in 2011, at least it will be, than in 2010. But I think that, you know, unless we see some big shock, like within oil prices, and everybody's watching what's going on in the Middle East very carefully because of that, we should be... you know, our projection should be pretty reasonable.
Okay. The next question I believe is for you as well, and it's actually several questions, so I'm just going to start one by one. The first question is, where in the country are the freight corridors maintaining growing according to the two categories of growth for vehicles and computer electronics?
Yeah, you know, I didn't break things down into freight corridors, so I don't have that answer on the top of my head right now. But I imagine, you know, you would see corridors growing out of California. You'd see some manufacturing in the Southeast. You'd see some increased manufacturing as well. I don't know if we're going to see it return so much to places like the Upper Midwest, the Rust Belt, that area. I think we'll see things. We'll see the growth much slower in places like that. But in terms of those particular sectors, I haven't looked at. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head.
Okay, and I don't know about the next question. Is where can money be slowed down for those sectors losing growth, textiles, clothing?
I'm not sure I follow what the question is.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's worded the right way. We'll go on to the next question. Deb, if you want to repost, you know, maybe clarify that question. The next question is, will the imports cause continuing coastal congestion, and when will we hit the maximum capacity for accepting those imports at the ports?
Well, in 2005, 2006, we saw really serious congestion, particularly at LA and Long Beach. Ken might be able to answer this question as well. What a lot of shippers did is they diversified their supply chain so that they were not dependent on just that one gateway. And with the opening of the canal, with other ports that have appeared on the horizon since then, such as Prince Rupert in Canada, even Lázaro Cárdenas in Mexico, these are ports that weren't really active in 2006. Less likelihood of a congestion at a single port affecting the entire system.
Yeah, and to your point, yeah, scalability is still available at Prince Rupert. Lázaro is domestically used for our Mexican operations, not domestic U.S. As far as other ports, with the steamship contracts and the way it worked out from 9 to 10, it is, in some cases, cost advantageous to still do a land bridge over from California to other ports when the Panama Canal opens up in 14. We see that trend changing.
Okay. The next question also for you, Steve. What level of highway investment and other transportation infrastructure investment is assumed by IHS?
Not a very high one, and I put that slide up that did have state and local investment. But one of the issues, and Randy, I think, touched on this in his presentation, is we expect state and local governments to have more responsibility at the same time that they have fewer funds available. So we're not expecting a lot of federal investment. The stimulus is over, so as a percentage of last year, it may be lower. The state and local portion of it, again, a lot of the states don't have the money to dump into highway projects. So we are seeing a relatively low level of investment compared to maybe some other years.
Okay. Randy, there's two comments in here, I think, directed towards you, stating that trucks only contribute 13% of miles driven versus 40% of the highway trust funding is misleading, given that it is the weight and size of the vehicle that impacts the system from a maintenance and congestion standpoint. And then similarly, I have seen reports that compare the vehicle miles traveled by truck equate to 2,000 passenger vehicles and the amount of damage to the road. I'm not sure that your slide showed that trucks pay 40% of highway trust fund total and drive 13% of the miles takes the road damage caused by trucks into consideration. So I'll just give you a chance to comment on that.
Yeah, I don't know that there's, I know that there was a study back in the late 90s that indicates that there was this significant damage caused by overweight trucks. I think that since there hasn't been any recent studies on that, that it's difficult to say in actuality that trucks don't pay their fair share or that they do pay their fair share. My thing was just strictly for illustration purposes so that people didn't think that trucks necessarily got a free ride. There's also a lot of research going on right now of single wide tires, different configurations, different axle spreads, different pavement mixes, which actually indicate that the damage caused by trucks may actually be going down relative to the way it was using old tires, much more pressure in those tires, that sort of thing. No air ride. So I think that it's debatable about do trucks not pay their fair share? And the other thing that I would say is that the industry is on record of saying that they would be willing to pay higher fuel taxes as long as those taxes are going into highway projects.
Okay, thank you. The next question is for Randy and Ken. To what extent are you using scores from the new CSA, which is Compliance, Safety, and Accountability Program through FMCSA. So to what extent are you using scores from the new CSA safety monitoring system to select carriers? Is it something you're already doing, or are you waiting until the information is more complete and normalized?
Well, this is Randy. I'll take the first stab at that. We have a very large spend through Menlo and through Conway Freight in buying truckload services. So we have made use of the previous carrier rating system that FMCSA had in place, and we have run every one of our current stable of carriers through the CSA model to help rank them. The public data is not complete yet. There are seven basics. Two of the seven basics are not yet available to the public because FMCSA is still doing some work on making sure that they really are meaningful. So as a result, we have not taken significant action until those last two basics are right and we know that they are right. I think that Ken was exactly correct, though, in saying that a lot of this is going to be based on court cases rather than what our assumptions are, and that will drive what we ultimately start ranking are using to rank people or carriers.
Yeah, and the day that the rankings came out, we ranked every carrier. We put them in different percentiles of, like I mentioned. Now, 50% of our carriers have two alerts or less, which is okay. So carriers with four or more, and we have a few, we're having conversations with them. The point about not having access to all of the report, we are requesting those carriers to send us the parts that are only viewable by themselves to understand what is the total risk, what's the total performance of a carrier. Now, in the selection criteria of onboarding new carriers, we haven't determined what criteria we're going to use to select or not select. To the point about FMCSA still has only three categories to determine whether a carrier is safe, satisfactory, conditional, or unsatisfactory. That's still the governing body of whether a carrier does business in the United States or not. Now, CSA is great, gives you a lot of different references, but until the FMCSA changes something going forward in our contracts, it still just states that you must be a satisfactory carrier.
Okay. We have about three more questions. If our presenters are available to stay on just a few extra minutes, I think we'll just try to get through them.
Yep.
Okay. So the next question is, do you think the just-in-time conveniences will decrease significantly as we try to fill the containers and move towards efficiency? I'll open that to any of the presenters.
Well, if the carrying cost of inventory becomes more impactful, there will be more just-in-time because we won't want to carry it in the building. So I can say that is something that could happen and occur.
Any of the other presenters have any thoughts on that?
Well, I've got a thought on that, that I think that's exactly right. We have not seen from our customers any inkling that they still are not demanding high levels of service and fast service. And then the other thing I think is that this gets blurred a little bit in Ken made a very good point about trying to fill up empty miles and things like that. And we have, as a country, this illusion that every lane that we move in is balanced. And the only thing I'll say to that is, New York City consumes an awful, awful lot. There will always be a lot of empties coming out of New York City because there's no manufacturing there. The only production is limited, and the biggest export is probably trash. So the quest to perfectly balance systems and get rid of empties across all modes is almost a false trail.
Okay. The next question is also open to any of the presenters. Would there be any routes in the U.S. that would be able to support land trains? Any advantages to the economy, livability, reduction in diesel fuel use, or any other advantage?
This is Randy again. If they're talking about the road train that is used extensively in the rural areas of Australia, there's a lot of research going on in the United States right now around what's called platooning and the road trains connecting vehicles together electronically so they all move in harmony with each other. We probably have some areas that make sense for that, particularly in flat rural areas, but we don't have public policy that would allow us to do that at this point.
Okay. Anyone else?
I mean, there have been studies recently about dedicated truck lanes and high and things of that nature, triples, quads, things like that, but nothing has. As Randy said, there's been no public policy to support any of that.
Okay. The next question is for Ken. What kind of impacts has Walmart been facing as a result of ocean shipping lines increasing their slow steaming operations, especially for goods with higher time sensitivity?
It's a concern with the limited capacity as our imports are starting to grow again. Into the United States. It is causing some out-of-stock issues, and we really haven't figured and determined what's the next best course of action. So we're having a lot of dialogue. It's not that the ships don't exist, they just haven't put them back in service.
Okay. And then one final question. I'm not sure that anybody can really answer this, but why do the railroads and government agencies continue to build intermodal facilities in urban areas at the same time they try to reduce urban truck congestion?
think we need a rail representative to answer.
Well, we'll leave it at that. I'll just put it out there. If anybody on the line wants to comment in the chat box and, you know, respond to that, feel free to. You know, we always encourage dialogue in the chat box as well. Well, I know we're a few minutes over, so I think we're going to go ahead and close out for today. Thank you, all three presenters, for your great presentations. Thank you, everybody, for your patience with some of the audio issues at the beginning. And I'm glad that we were able to keep everybody, you know, on the voiceover IP after we got it all worked out. The recorded version of today's event will be available online within the next few weeks on the Talking Freight website, and I will send out an email when that is available. If you are an AICP member and want to receive 1.5 certification maintenance credits for today, please make sure you're either signed in with your first and last name or type your name into the chat box or send me an email. As I mentioned, this seminar is not currently available on the AICP website for logging credits, but I'll send out an email once AICP approves it and it's up there. I encourage everybody to download the evaluation form and send it to me after you've completed it. We want to make these seminars as, you know, best for you as possible. The next seminar will be held on March 16th and is called America's Marine Highways. It's not currently available for registration. It should be within the next day or so, and I will be sending an email to the Freight Planning Listserv once it is available. So if you don't already belong to the listserv, I suggest you register. That's our primary way of advertising Talking Freight. So thank you to our presenters, and thank you everybody in attendance, and enjoy the rest of your day.